Chapter 6. Juan Cabrillo sat behind his desk, his feet propped up on the inlaid wood as he read eddies and links after action reports off his tablet PC. Despite what had to have been a hair-raising series of events, both men made the material dull, exhorting their partner's contribution to the mission over their own and downplaying the dangers until it almost read like stereo instructions. He jotted a couple of notes using a light pen and sent the electronic reports to the computer's archive. He then checked the weather services. The ninth major Atlantic storm of the year was forming to their north, and while it wasn't a threat to the Oregon, he was interested because so far three storms had become hurricanes and the season was only a month old. Forecasters were predicting that this year would rival or even top the number of named storms that slammed the United States in 2005, destroying New Orleans and severely damaging Texas's Gulf Coast. The experts claimed that this was part of a normal cycle of hurricane severity and frequency. However, environmental groups were clamoring that the superstorms were the result of global warming. Juan put his stock with the forecasters, but the trend was troubling. The weather along Africa's southwestern coast looked clear for at least the next 5 days. Unlike his disheveled appearance playing at a greedy officer aboard a tramp steamer the night before, the morning found Cabrillo freshly showered and wearing a pair of English-cut blue jeans, a Turnbull and Asser shirt open at the throat, and a pair of deck shoes without socks. Because people would see his ankles, he had donned a prosthetic right leg covered in flesh-toned rubber, rather than one of his more mechanical-looking limbs. He kept his hair short, just longer than a crew cut, and despite his Latino name and heritage, his hair was bleached almost white by a California upbringing spent mostly in the sun and surf. The armored porthole covers had been lowered so his cabin was bathed in natural light. The teak wainscoting, floors, and coffered ceiling gleamed with a fresh coat of polish. From his desk, he could see through to his bedroom, which was dominated by a massive hand-carved four-poster, and beyond to the head, with its Mexican tile shower stall and copper jacuzzi tub and sink basin. The rooms had the masculine smell of Juan's aftershave and the occasional La Troya Universalis Cuban cigars he enjoyed. The decor was simple and elegant and showed Juan's eclectic tastes. On one wall was a painting of the Oregon plowing through an angry sea, while another had glass-fronted shelves for some of the curios he had picked up from his travels, a clay figurine of an Egyptian Ushabti, a stone bowl from the Aztec Empire, a prayer wheel from Tibet, a piece of scrimshaw, a Gurkha knife, a doll made of seal fur from Greenland, a piece of raw emerald from Colombia, and dozens of other items. The furniture was mostly dark and the lighting was discreet and recessed, while the throw rugs on the floor were silk Persians in bright colors. The one telling thing in the room was the lack of photographs. Where most men at sea had pictures of their wives and children, there were no such snapshots in Juan's cabin. He had been married, but her fatal drunk driving accident 11 years ago was a pain Juan had tucked deep inside and refused to acknowledge. He took a sip of rich Kona coffee, noted the service set, and smiled. Two of the things that enabled him to recruit and keep some of the best from America's armed forces and intelligence services were he paid well and spared no expense on his crew, be it pricey china in the mess hall and Le Cordon Bleu trained chefs in the galley, or the decorating allowance he gave each new team member to redo their private cabins. Mark Murphy had used up most of his budget on a sound system that could shake barnacles off the hull. Linda Ross had engaged a New York City decorator in her cabin, while Lynx was as Spartan as a Navy barracks, the money instead going toward the Harley Davidson he kept in the hold. The Oregon sported a large fitness facility with saunas, and when not on an assignment, one of her ballast wants could be half-filled and turned into an Olympic-length swimming pool. The men and women of the corporation lived well, but as exemplified in this most recent mission, they also lived dangerously. Every member of the crew was a stockholder, and while the officers enjoyed the lion's share of the profits, Juan's favorite task at the end of an operation was signing bonus checks for the technicians and auxiliary personnel. That would total some $500,000 for the job they'd just pulled off. He was just about to start typing his report to Langston Overholt, his old friend at the CIA who brought the corporation a great deal of business, when someone knocked on his door. "Come." Linda Ross and Mark Murphy stepped into his cabin. Where Linda was perky and petite, Murph was gangly and awkward with shaggy dark hair, a goatee that a single swipe with a razor would erase, and a habit of wearing nothing but black. One of the few on the ship without a military background, Mark was a certified genius who had earned his PhD by the time he was 20. He'd gone into R&D for a defense contractor where he'd met Eric Stone, who was in the Navy then, but a short-timer with a contract to come and work for Juan. Eric had convinced Cabrillo that the young weapons expert would be a perfect fit for the corporation, and in the 3 years since, and despite Murph's taste for punk music and how he would turn the ship's deck into a skateboard park, Juan couldn't have agreed more. Cabrillo glanced at the antique chronograph across from his desk. "Either you two completely struck out or you hit a home run to get back to me this quickly." "Let's say we're on third," Murph said, adjusting the bundle of papers in his arms. "And for the record, I don't like sports metaphors because I don't get them half the time." So, this was a slam dunk more than a Hail Mary. Juan grinned.
"If you say so."
They took seats opposite Juan, who cleared a bunch of papers off his desk.
"Okay, what do you have?"
"Where do you want to start?" Linda asked. "The kidnapping or the company?"
"Let's start with the background first so I know who we're dealing with." Juan laced his fingers behind his head and stared at the ceiling while Linda began her report. It might have been rude not to look her in the eye, but it was one of his quirks when concentrating.
"Jeffrey Merrick, age 51. Divorced with two grown children, both of whom spend their time blowing through their father's money by chasing paparazzi so they can end up in tabloids. The wife is an artist living in New Mexico and keeps a low profile. Merrick graduated with a PhD in chemistry from MIT, exactly one day younger than Mark was when he received his, and partnered up with another alum, Daniel Singer, to form Merrick Singer, a materials research company. The firm has applied for and received 80 patents in the past 25-odd years, and the company has grown from the two of them in a rented space outside Boston to a campus near Geneva, Switzerland, with a staff of 160. As you may know, their biggest patent is for an organic-based system to filter up to 90% of the sulfur out of the smoke emitted by coal-fired power plants. A year after it was issued, Merrick Singer went public and both men became billionaires. That isn't to say there wasn't a lot of controversy at the time, which still echoes today. Environmental groups say that even with the scrubbers, coal plants are too dirty and should be shut down. Numerous lawsuits are still pending and new ones are being filed every year. "Could eco-terrorists have abducted Merrick?" Juan interrupted.
"The Swiss police are looking into that possibility," Linda said. "But it doesn't seem likely."
"What would be the point?"
"Getting back to the story. 10 years after they hit it big with their IPO, a rift developed between Merrick and his partner. Up until this time, the two had been as close as brothers. They always appeared together at press conferences. Their families even vacationed together. Then, in the span of a couple of months, Singer seemed to have gone through a personality change. He started siding with the environmentalists in the suits brought against his own company and eventually forced Merrick to buy him out entirely. His shares were valued at $2.4 billion, and Merrick had to scramble to come up with that kind of cash. To make it happen, he had to personally buy back all the shares of Merrick Singer. It nearly bankrupted him.
Real Cain and Abel type stuff, Mark Murphy interjected.
At the time, it was front page news in all the financial papers.
What's Singer been doing since?
After his wife left him, he's been living on the coast of Maine, near where he grew up. Up until about 5 years ago, he was using his wealth to support all kinds of environmental causes, some on the extreme side of things. Then he suddenly filed fraud claims against a number of environmental groups, saying they had bilked him. Said the whole movement was just a way for the people in charge of the various charities to make money for themselves, and that they did nothing to really help the planet. The suits are still pending, though Singer himself is pretty much dropped out of sight.
So he's some kind of hermit now?
No, just real low-key. While doing the research, I got the sense that Merrick was the front man and Singer the brains, even though they shared the podium. Merrick glad-handed everyone and really knew his way around Capitol Hill, and later in the halls of power in Bern when they moved the company to Switzerland. He wore the $1,000 suits while Singer sported jeans and a poorly knotted tie. Merrick loved the limelight and Singer the shadows. I think since leaving the company, he's just reverted back to his introverted self.
Doesn't sound like a criminal mastermind to me, Juan said.
I don't think so either. He's just a scientist with a fat wallet.
Okay, so we're stuck with a kidnapping for ransom. Or is there anyone else out there gunning for Merrick?
Since the showdown with Singer, the company's been running smoothly.
What exactly do they do?
Now that they're privately held, it's mostly pure research funded by Merrick. They still receive a few patents a year, nothing earth-shattering, just a better molecular glue for some esoteric application, or a foam that can withstand a few tenths of a degree more than something else already on the market.
Anything someone would try to steal through industrial espionage?
Nothing we could find. But they could be working on something in secret.
Okay, we'll keep that in mind. Tell me about the kidnapping itself.
Mark straightened in his chair. Merrick and a researcher named Susan Dunleavy were seen by the security guard at the main building on their campus at 7 last night, chatting on their way out the door. Merrick had a dinner date with reservations for 8 o'clock. Dunleavy lives alone and apparently didn't have plans. They left Merrick Singer in separate vehicles, Merrick in his Mercedes and Dunleavy in a Volkswagen. Their cars were found a half mile from the facility. By studying the tire marks, the police were able to determine that a third vehicle, given the length of its wheelbase, most likely it was a van, forced both vehicles off the road at high speed. Airbags were deployed in the Mercedes, but not in the Volkswagen. Presumably, Merrick was hit first, and Susan Dunleavy was slowing when the van hit her. The driver's side window on Merrick's car was smashed inward so the door could be unlocked. The Volkswagen didn't have automatic locks, so she was simply pulled from the car.
How did they know this was a kidnapping and not some good Samaritan rescuing them and taking them to a local hospital? Cabrillo asked.
Because they aren't at any local hospitals, leading the police to conclude they were locked in the Good Samaritan's basement.
Right.
So far, there have been no ransom demands, and the search for the vans turned up nothing. Eventually, they will find it at the airport, because we know Merrick, and most likely Susan Dunleavy as well, were taken out of the country by plane.
Have you checked charter flights out of Geneva for last night?
Eric's on that now. There are more than 50 because an economic summit meeting just concluded and all the bigwigs were headed home. Juan rolled his eyes.
Figures.
Might not be bad luck on our part, but thorough planning on theirs, Linda said.
Good point.
So far, the police don't know what to make of the situation.
They're playing the wait-and-see game until the kidnappers make their demands.
Could this have been about Susan Dunleavy and not Jeffrey Merrick? Juan suggested.
Mark shook his head. Doubt it. I checked her on the company database. She's been with them for 2 years, a researcher in organic chemistry still working toward her doctorate. Like I said before, she lives alone. No husband or kids. Most employee bios give a little info about interests and hobbies. Hers only gave her professional credentials. Nothing personal at all. No one, a kidnapper, would go through the expense of hiring a private jet to grab.
Doesn't wash no matter how you look at it, Linda said.
Merrick was the target, and I bet Dunleavy was nabbed because she was a witness.
What about this Devil's Oasis that was mentioned? Juan asked to get them back on track.
We couldn't find any mention of it on the internet, Linda replied. It has to be a code name, so it could be any place. Backtracking from where we intercepted the call when they said they would reach it by 4 in the morning, it could be in a circle big enough to encompass the eastern tip of South America. Or they could have turned northward again and gone back to Europe.
That doesn't sound likely. Let's assume that they continued on the same straight-line course south from Switzerland that took them over our position last night. What's the most likely landing site?
Someplace in Namibia, Botswana, Zimbabwe, or South Africa.
And with our luck, what do you bet it's Zimbabwe? Mark muttered.
Years of corruption and poor economic planning had turned the once prosperous country into one of the poorest nations on the continent. Simmering anger against the repressive government was threatening to boil over. Reports of attacks against remote villages that spoke out against the regime were growing, while malnutrition and the diseases it spawned were on the rise. All indicators pointed to a full-scale civil war erupting in months or maybe even weeks.
Again, maybe not our bad luck, but their good planning, Linda said. The middle of a war zone would be the last place I'd look for a kidnapped industrialist. They could easily bribe the government to look the other way when they brought him in.
Okay. Concentrate your search efforts on the Devil's Oasis being in Zimbabwe, but don't rule out anything. We'll keep steaming southward, and hopefully you'll have something by the time we reach the Tropic of Capricorn. Meanwhile, I'm going to talk with Langston to see if the CIA has anything on this, and maybe have him send out some feelers to the Swiss government, as well as the board of Merrick Singer. Let them know they might have options.
This isn't our usual way of doing things, Chairman.
I know, Linda. But we might be in the right place at the right time to make this all work out.
Or the kidnappers are going to issue their demands today. Merrick Singer will pay the ransom, and good old Jeffrey Boy will be home in time for dinner.
You're forgetting one critical piece. Juan didn't match her light tone. Flying him out of the country is a risk they didn't need if this was about a cash ransom. If that's all they wanted, they would have stashed him someplace within Switzerland, issued their demands, and been done with it. If their planning is as meticulous as you suspect, there has to be another level to their plot we haven't seen.
Linda Ross nodded, sensing the gravity of the situation.
Like what?
Find the Devil's Oasis, and maybe we'll know.